welcome to Cairo Nights. News boss Frank Shires is here, of course. Chairman of the board, Shane Peterson, is also here. I am Mike Lewis. I am wondering now where we're going with the list on who is going to be the acceptable first receivers of the vaccine. I think it's a dynamite move on frontline providers. I'm a little concerned. There is actually one of the folks on the committee, the CDC committee in Washington, D.C., who voted, the one person who voted against it, raised, I thought, an excellent point. And that point was this, that while it's a great idea to have some of the people most affected by the coronavirus, folks in-home care, in residential care, while it's great to have them vaccinated, the downside, of course, is that very, very little of the testing was done on this group of folks. And her concern was that, well, we're going to be putting a vaccine out there with people who actually weren't really much a part of the control group in the testing. And I thought that was, you know, it didn't get a lot of attention, but I thought that's an excellent point, because typically we're racing this thing through as quickly as possible. That is a vulnerable group of people, maybe many with other health conditions. And on the other hand, the fatality rate is extraordinarily high in residential facilities like that. So, you know, I think the decision is essentially, well, we're going to roll the dice. It's looking like where we had our first hot spot in Washington State over in Kirkland. It's looking like one of those situations where, well, which path do you pick? You know, this is an exceptionally difficult set of decisions that healthcare officials are making, and I don't envy them that. But I would think that once we get nurses, doctors, folks who are on the front lines against the coronavirus, and I would actually include emergency responders as well. And I don't know, it wasn't clear to me that they are included as well, but I would probably include them on the first wave of vaccines. It does make some sense to take the other vulnerable groups, but I think that is a word of caution about what do we know about how it's going to affect somebody, you know, who is maybe in their 70s or 80s or 90s. But the fact that we're having a discussion about a vaccine, I think, is tremendously important. Nearly 37,000 Americans so far in November died of COVID-19, the most of any month since the early days of the pandemic. This is testing the capacity of hospitals, testing the capacity of morgues, of funeral homes, you name it, and people's ability to process this information. I mean, it feels like we have done nothing but a endless fire hose, a cascade of bad news about this. I'm hoping that at some point we're going to start providing better news than theoretical better news, like we hope for a vaccine soon. I mean, I'm hoping that we start seeing some sort of change here quickly. But amid the resurgence, states have begun reopening field hospitals. If you remember correctly, there was a field hospital opened here in Seattle briefly. And I think one at Starfire Field down in Kent. And there was another one planned for they started assembling it for the Expo Center here in Seattle. And both were taken down fairly quickly and shipped to other places that seemed to need them more. But now it looks like that there is going to be a potential influx of patients. We are running out of intensive care beds in a lot of states. Washington, Seattle is still holding fast, but still it's becoming a worry here as well. CBS News correspondent David Bergnaud reports that the first coronavirus case in the United States was actually much earlier than we originally thought.
The first cases of coronavirus in the United States, turns out it was found as far back as December of 2019, even before China reported its first case. How do we know that? Well, it turns out the CDC sent researchers to
approval in the U.S. If granted, Pfizer believes their vaccine could be launched in the European Union this month.
Yeah, so that is really interesting. There was some pretty interesting coverage on the fact that the Trump administration is leaning pretty hard on the FDA to get that approval before Great Britain does. The one thing about the FDA that it's probably important to note, and I think if you have anybody in your family or in your friends who have worked in medical research, especially stuff that needs to be approved by the FDA, they are known for being a highly, highly detailed organization. In fact, frequently are considered sort of a gold standard in some ways, at least as far as their clearance of drugs to get on the market. And This is a process. They do their own. So a lot of these regulatory groups in many countries, they sort of take what the companies and the researchers give them and assess that and then decide whether or not to go ahead. The FDA goes back down to zero and takes all the original data and assesses that. And that's what's taking the FDA, as I understand it, taking the FDA a little bit longer, thousands and thousands of pages to review before they actually approve these two drugs. But they both look likely to be approved maybe as soon as next week. And as Frank said on the news, a possibility of seeing that, at least for that initial wave of folks, according to the CDC, maybe within 2 weeks, maybe 2.5 or 3 weeks. The other thing that's interesting is also the federal government is aligning itself with the various national air carriers. All the airlines have also said that they are going to be heavily involved in moving this, in shipping this around the country, and that they are going to make, well, I mean, on the downside and the upside, there's a lot of empty planes out there. And so they're going to be making aircraft available to be shipping vaccines across the country when it's manufactured and so we can move it. And like they said on the news, there's only initially enough for about 20 million Americans. Obviously, that's not it's a massive amount compared to what we have now, not a massive amount compared to what we need, because if you see 40 million vaccines, that means half the number for people vaccinated, because the early stage, at least for the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines, they're both a vaccine and then a booster shot, both of them. So those doses actually have to be a double applied, you know, within a gap between the two doses. But this is now where we're at the place where we're starting to get that official list of who is going to be getting the vaccine first. These are not binding rules. So when the Centers for Disease Control today, when it gave its list of how we should tier the folks receiving the vaccine, all they can do is make a recommendation to the states, and then the states have to make their own decisions. They will be apportioning the vaccine based on population. So obviously what that means is larger states will be getting more, smaller states will be getting less. The panel voted 13-1, and I talked to you about that one no vote earlier, to approve these guidelines. The guidelines are going to be employees of nursing homes and similar facilities will be the first people in the United States to receive the vaccines, along with healthcare workers who are especially at risk of being exposed to the virus. And as I said before, according to the New York Times, the states are not required to follow the panel's recommendations, but they usually do. The final decision will rest with every governor, who are consulting with their top health officials as they complete the distribution plans. Now, Dr. Jeff Duchin, health officer with Public Health of Seattle King County, said it's possible that doses might be available later this month. He is not optimistic about the earliest possible date that vaccines could arrive. He said the committee's vote allows the state and local agencies to move forward with planning on how to allocate those doses. This is from the Seattle Times. The State Department of Health is working to refine its interim plan to distribute these vaccines, which was first published in October, and additional details are due to the CDC by Friday. The pharmaceutical companies Moderna and Pfizer this month will seek emergency use authorizations. So this means that about 21 million people are going to be getting this, and about 3 million people living in skilled nursing facilities or assisted living facilities or other residential care facilities will also be getting the vaccine. And Duchin also said this. He said, "We need to protect our healthcare workers. They've been putting their lives on the line for us during this outbreak." And he has also served on that national work group on this very matter. And so this is where we're at now. We're going to be getting rolling into that period where certain people are getting vaccinated. But I think as has been said on the national reports and the local reports, I don't know if you are someone like me who is neither a frontline worker, and you're not any sort of an emergency worker. You're not a person in what would be considered the high risk group inside of a residential care facility. Your best bet is to continue doing what you're doing and expect that it's going to be a while before you actually have access to a vaccine. And if you haven't gotten a flu shot, you absolutely should. I went ahead and got mine. They're cheap or very low cost. If you have insurance, it's usually free. You can get it through Bartels, your local pharmacy, or your doctor. A very good idea, because they say that getting the flu along with this is really, really critical. And every month we go, so every week we go from now until we have a vaccine, you can expect those infection rates to rise. And that means the hospitalization rate is going to rise. And that means that the critical hospitalization rate is going to rise. And this is what the whole concern is about. So none of this is obviously any sort of, and I don't think anyone would take it as such, to relax your standards, but also understand that even as people start to get vaccinated, for the bulk of the population, the world is not going to change a whole lot in the short term. It's going to remain the same. And then hopefully at some point in the new year, we'll start seeing a little bit of improvement. Cairo News' Lauren Donovan has the inside scoop on transportation and storage of the vaccine here in King County, which we've talked about quite a bit on this show.
They need to be kept extremely cold. We're talking 94 degrees below zero. And so to store it, you need a power freezer. It's got a price tag of roughly $15,000. And we're told Harborview just bought two of them. If that's not available, dry ice can serve as a substitute for up to 20 days.
Maintaining that cold chain custody is going to be extremely important to keeping these vaccines effective.
They arrive here at the runway in SeaTac in just a couple of weeks.
So we've actually, in a couple of cases, we've talked to one expert at PATH, another expert at the University of Washington, both of whom are familiar with the process of moving vaccines, and both have said the issue with these first two vaccines, and less so with the AstraZeneca vaccine, although that one has its own set of issues, but is the cold chain. It's the capacity to move them and keep them very, very cold. The Pfizer one in particular at she said minus 90. I had heard minus 70. Regardless, that's Celsius too. Regardless, that is a very, very specialized freezer. There are some of those in existence in this area because there's a lot of vaccine work that happens in this area. So we're lucky in that regard. Once you get outside of Seattle, those get a lot more rare, it's a lot harder to find. Those sort of storage facilities. And so my understanding is that these freezers, not only are they getting to be very difficult to find, they are getting purchased by the big transportation companies, the UPSs, the UPS, the FedExes, USPS of the world. They're actually creating small freezer farms to allow them to be able to pull this stuff, to move this stuff around the country and be able to keep it in its super cold environment while the dispersal plan for any individual area is figured out. And so this is now moving from the medical area to the logistical area. And if any of you work in logistical transportation, you understand how difficult it will be to move this vaccine over time to as many people as need it, particularly when it needs to be kept cold. It's difficult to move anything that needs to be kept in cold storage, but particularly something that has to be as extraordinarily cold as this. The dry ice issue is going to help, but remember, there's also that is not like the manufacturing of dry ice is not necessarily something you can necessarily count on. That is something that you can also run in low supply of. So it's going to be very, very important as we move through here to watch the supply chain, because it is going to be the big problem that we're going to have to be solving nationally. One of the other problems in this whole situation has been with the shutdown that was announced by the governor just a week ago, 2 weeks ago. We are now in a phase where there are some restaurants still open. They're open up outside. You've seen various models of outdoor structures, including the igloo structures and the tent structures. This is going to be a long, cold winter as a result. The idea of being able to go out and meet with somebody and have a bite to eat is, you know, it feels just like it's such a normal thing to have lost. On the other hand, it is what they're trying to minimize as much as possible. But is that outside seating safe? Well, it turns out that people are actually taking a look at that, including King County Public Health. You've seen, if you've been in Ballard, for example, you've seen these igloo-like structures. And what they say essentially is this, and we're going to actually have tomorrow on the show, we're going to be talking with Bethany Jean Clement. She is a food writer and has been paying a lot of attention to both the restaurant closures and the permanent restaurant closures and the issues regarding outdoor dining. We're going to have her on tomorrow to go into some detail on this. But to give you a brief idea, what they say is, and this is from Gabriel Spitzer of King County Public Health. He says, we know that the viruses can build up an air of poorly ventilated spaces, and enclosed space that happens to be outdoors should also be enough open enough to allow airflow. So that means that if you're in outdoor seating and it's enclosed on three sides, you're probably not doing yourself a whole lot of favors. If it is something that allows the air to move through, well, then you're going to be significantly colder, but you're probably going to be a bit safer. That's what the health officials say, that the outdoor dining isn't just about being colder. It's actually about the air circulation. That is really the critical thing. And when you get the air circulation, then suddenly you actually have the virus being dispersed, because part of the problem with the virus, of course, is viral load. It's not just your exposure, which could infect you, but also how much of the virus you actually get when you are exposed. And that somehow, in some ways, determines how sick you might get. So that's why they're saying, like, it's important to not just look that you're outside, but what are the conditions surrounding where you are. All right, coming up, we are going to talk to, just in the next segment, we're going to be talking to Rachel Bell. She has an interesting story on the fact that the new president and his family apparently want to bring a cat into the White House. And that is not, while that's not incredibly rare, it hasn't happened in a long time. We're going to talk to Rachel about that right after the break. One of the things that happened today, actually, in the news was that Mitch McConnell made an unusual reference. He referred to something, stimulus package being associated with the, quote, new administration, which was the first step he made in acknowledging that there is going to be a different president than President Trump. And then you told me something about this new administration as well that caught me off guard.
Yeah. So a few weeks ago, most of America, let's just say, I don't know where I got most from. Most of America, half of America, was right. Very excited that the Bidens are bringing a dog back into the White House. People really like a president with a pet. And this is the first time that a rescue dog will be in the White House. So Joe and Jill have two dogs, two German shepherds called Champ and Major. But when this news came out, I said, I don't care at all, because I'm a cat person and I want more cats in the White House. And I think that the White House heard my plea, because it was just announced, according to CBS Sunday Morning, confirmed that there's going to be a cat in the White House. Now, they said it's been confirmed that they're going to adopt a cat when they move into the White House. Here's the actual quote. I don't really feel like this is a confirmation. Jill Biden told CBS Sunday Morning, quote, well, I'd love to get a cat. I love having animals around the house. And CBS Sunday Morning was like, breaking news, cat in the White House. I'm going to take it as fact as well.
I am wondering whether or not, I mean, there's that famous line, who was it that said it, Harry Truman, about if you want a friend in Washington, you get a dog. It feels like a cat's given, I love cats, you and I both have cats, but cats can be a little bit indifferent. They seem to want you to please them more than they want to please you. And it feels like a cat in Washington, D.C. is almost redundant, certainly in political circles. That's everyone you're dealing with has more cat-like qualities than dog-like qualities. Maybe that's why the cat thing hasn't been as big in the White House as you would expect.
Well, it's not that it hasn't been that big. Let me go back and tell you a little history in the White House, all gotten from a very trusted source, everyone's favorite, thenoseprint.com.
Of course.
So President Lincoln was the first to bring a cat into the White House, and he was very into cats. It said that he even rescued three motherless kittens while visiting General Grant during the Civil War, which seems like maybe you shouldn't be so distracted. And it said he regularly played with kitties to relieve stress during his presidency. Let's see. There's some funny ones.
And that
here
was a very, very stressful presidency.
1861 to yes. 1865.
That's about as stressful as it gets.
President Theodore Roosevelt had a six-toed cat named Slippers and a cat named Tom Quartz. Where's my one? That's my favorite one here. There's so many. President Clinton had Socks. And the last cat in the White House was President George W. Bush. He had a cat named Willie. and, oh, India Willie Bush. So there have been some cats. But what I keep thinking of is the White House is so huge, and cats love to just settle into these little nooks and crannies. How would you ever even find your cat? You'd have to have, like, a wing only for that cat.
I was actually thinking the same thing. I was thinking about what, I mean, because have you ever been to the White House?
Not for a very long time, but yes.
I did the tour, like I think a lot of
citizens
have. And even that small section of the White House that you see, which is, you probably don't even see a quarter of it. It seems odd. I mean, I know that there's got to be areas there, the bedrooms and whatnot, that are sealed off from everyone else. And so maybe those are much more preventable about what can come and go. But I was kind of thinking the same thing, like, that seems like an awfully big place for a cat. It's
totally
bigger than a bookstore.
And, like, please don't scratch the couch that Teddy Roosevelt sat upon.
Right.
You know?
Because they have no shame.
No. Like, what if it peed on Lincoln's hat or something?
Right. Lincoln's hat.
It's probably in there somewhere. Do we have
time? We did get a chance to visit Lincoln's hat when I was there.
The cat in the hat. I didn't
exactly
even think about that. Do we have time for two stories?
We do, actually.
Okay. I wanted to talk about two of our favorite things, cats and tampons. Over the years, if people have been listening, I have talked about tampons not infrequently because I just feel like talking about periods needs to be normalized. And this story is a great example of that. So last week in Scotland, they became the first country in the world to provide free pads and tampons in all public bathrooms. So that includes places like libraries and museums, government buildings, all schools and universities. And the best way to relate to this is it's treated like toilet paper. Anytime you go to a public place, there is always toilet paper. I'm sure people who've been to Europe have had the experience where sometimes you have to buy toilet paper, and that
is
rough when you don't have that change in your pocket. And so there's something called period poverty, which is a lot of women don't have the money to buy these products, and this can impact somebody's life. So there's a professor at a professor of public health at St. Louis University. She found that there weren't any studies done on this. So she studied 183 low-income women in St. Louis and found that 64% of them had to go without period products in the last year. She calls it an issue of dignity, but points out that a lot of women miss a job interview, or they don't go to work, or students don't go to school because they don't have these products. And they are quite expensive, and there's something that's called the pink tax because the products are taxed as well, and a lot of states are trying to work on that. But there are four states in the U.S. only, California, New York, Georgia, and Virginia, that are required to have these products in middle and high schools. And in New York, they found that attendance rates for girls rose by 2.4%. So that's what they need right now, because we live in a country where only stats and money matter. In order to provide these products for free, they're thinking they need to show a lot about increased, decreased productivity in order to get people to sign on to pay for this.
Yeah, it's really kind of a shame, because it should be what is one of those things. I saw when I think it was the BBC tweeted something out about this just a week or so ago. And I remember thinking, like, well, that it's such an obvious, easy thing to do. It's not terribly expensive for a government to provide it. It has disproportionate benefit,
yeah,
especially from people who especially when you're dealing with the lower income. I mean, like that is not only is it not cheap, it can actually be have this really negative social effect if you can't actually use the products like that. But on top of all of that, if you are just a cynic, and I don't know how school funding works, say, in Great Britain, I do know how it works very well in California. If you just want to do it, make it a math problem, well, you're paid by student attendance. And so if a school can get its attendance, 2.2% would pay for everything. 2.4 would pay for everything if it actually works in the United States as it worked over there. I think this is a wonderful idea.
I do, too. And it's shocking that this goes, you know, to legislature and people vote no. It's like, really? Like, it's just it affects half the population. It is out of our control to have this phenomenon in our lives. And I think the best way to treat it is like toilet paper. Everybody just expects that there is free toilet paper everywhere you go. And this is no different. You know, you don't have the choice of whether or not you have to go to the bathroom and use toilet paper, and women don't have the choice of whether or not they're going to get their period and need a product to deal with it.
Well, and on top of that, the counter argument, of course, is that the toilet paper in schools, I'm sure, is required. In a public place, may not be. And this doesn't extend to every bathroom in the country. It extends to government controlled bathrooms, essentially, right? Schools, government bathrooms, things like that, libraries. That all does make some sense. And I don't, you know, even if it actually makes more sense in some ways than even the toilet paper. And I appreciate the fact that toilet paper is usually there. And I have traveled in places where, you know, you walk in and like, oh,
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Got to buy a square.
Because you're so used to it being everywhere when you go in the United States. And so it's nice to see that somebody else is doing it. And I really hope that people take a look at that and feel like immediately like we should follow suit, regardless of your political persuasion on this.
Exactly. And like I said, I think talking about it like this helps normalize it, because there are a lot of men who still are like, la, 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 I don't want to hear about it. This is gross. This is weird. And it's like, grow up, dude. And please vote yes on Project Period.
Absolutely. Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks.
Coming up at the top of the hour, we're going to talk to an expert, a professor at University of Princeton. He studies belief systems. And belief systems in the United States have been changing rapidly over the course of the last few years. He's going to explain to us why and maybe where we're headed at the top of the hour. Coming up. Welcome back to Pyro Nights. There we go. My headphones weren't quite working. So if you are a, I'm sure you are, Seahawks fan, we're going to be talking with Stacey Joe later in the evening, 9 o'clock hour. Her predictions, how they came out, how her challenger's predictions came out. Did she win? Did she lose? We know what happened with the Seahawks. I'm guessing there's none of you who have recorded this and now are waiting to watch it. So I won't worry about the spoiler. Of course, the Seahawks won. But just as a quick bit of advice, if you are a sports fan and a Seattle fan or a fan of all Seattle teams, don't miss. I think it's going on right now. In fact, we're probably getting pretty close, if not a little beyond halftime. The Sounders are in Dallas playing the Dallas Stars. They are. It is going to Dallas Stars. Dallas Stars. That would be the hockey team. They're playing Dallas and they are in the playoffs. This is interesting. This is the we're in the kind of one and done section of the playoffs, and the Sounders are favored to win this one and hopefully bring back another MLS Cup in this exceedingly weird season. Like other teams, if you haven't been following soccer, they are playing in empty stadiums, but the game is being televised. So check it out if you are a fan of all things Seattle. One of the things we've not been able to do is travel to Canada since March. The border's essentially been closed. There is essential travel that is allowed across the border, very little else. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau today said the ban on non-essential travel is not going to be lifted anytime soon until the infection rates are significantly lower. The U.S. has been kind of a world leader in infection rates, and so he has said, a quote, until the virus is significantly more under control everywhere around the world, we are not going to be releasing the restrictions at the border. He told the CBC, we're lucky that trade in essential goods and agricultural products, pharmaceuticals, are flowing back and forth as it always has. And he's right, actually, about that, because that actually hasn't been limited. It has been the travel up there. And the thing is that obviously, in many, many ways, this hurts business in Seattle, obviously, with people not coming here. But the tourism issue has been so difficult. If you've been down to the Pike Market or any of the downtown area, you've seen evidence of all of this. Many businesses have closed. All of them are hurting, with some notable exceptions on businesses that are doing well now. And so the loss of Canadian tourism right now, if there were still American tourism, they'd probably still be doing okay. So the loss of Canadian tourism is a huge impact financially, but in the grander scheme of things, I'm not sure how much worse it makes it than it already is. But for the Canadians, and certainly in Vancouver, they depend heavily on a lot of income, and Victoria as well, from the United States. And so lifting that ban is also imperative for the Canadians, but they're just waiting to see how much longer it's going to be before the virus gets under control. Most of the projections have it getting a bit worse, certainly with the fatality rate getting a bit worse through January, and then maybe at that point starting to level off. But we don't know yet. We will count it as we go, and we'll move along as necessary. The domestic travel has taken some upward ticks in the last since Thanksgiving. Obviously, Thanksgiving was a period of time when there are a lot of people, and you've heard, probably heard on every show on Cairo, people talking about how they didn't go anywhere. I didn't do anything. Normally, we do a big potluck down in our business. We didn't do that, obviously, this year because we are closed. But most people that I know in this area, certainly in this newsroom, stayed local. And a lot of other people, I do know, I have a couple of friends who actually did travel to see family, particularly if they could make it there by car. And so, you know, this is going to, man, I wish that we could sometimes just tell people, give people a little bit better news than that. But with the Canadians' decision on the border has been matched by most countries in Europe, this stuff isn't changing anytime soon. So we're going to still be in the mode of hunkering down and spending time with the people closest to us and hoping for and waiting for us to turn a corner in all of this. One thing we can do, though, is, and I get really lucky to be able to do this on the show, talk to people who are experts in areas where we have this sort of idea, but we don't know yet how to answer the questions that we've got. I've got Augustin Fuentes. He's a professor at Princeton, and he's an expert on belief systems and how our belief systems over the course of the past year, from believing in the coronavirus legitimacy to believing in, you know, the voting system legitimacy, things like that, how they've been tested in ways that they've never really been tested before, but how these giant belief systems are kind of fundamental in how we organize and behave in a society. Super interesting conversation coming up with him right after the break.